What is going on, everybody? Happy 2020. Happy playoff football. Happy we got the national championship right around the corner. Happy the draft isn't that far away. Happy New Year. Not that much going on today besides looking into the playoff games. Have some thoughts on Urban Meyer. I was here working on some other stuff, and I saw it came across the ticker. Ed Werder, I think went the long way around of just saying they fired Jason Garrett. He won't be back. I'm cowboyed out, but I do find the Cowboys' job and their connection with Urban Meyer, who Bruce Feldman tweeted today, at least Thursday, if you're listening, it might be Friday or Saturday. The Browns have interest. Of course they do. But just some thoughts on Urban Meyer and if he succeeds in the NFL. Something hit me just the last couple days watching the SEC. The SEC haters have lost. Like, the game's over. Just go home. Shut down your Twitter accounts. Just give up. Take the L on this one, and then we'll go over all the playoff games. And then, as of course, we do the Middlecoff mailbag. At John Middlecoff is my Instagram handle. DM's wide open. You slide right in, and you get your question answered here. So just ask a question. For those, I know we got a lot of new listeners, so sometimes I just say it like everyone knows. We do Middlecoff mailbag. At John Middlecoff is my Instagram, same as my Twitter. And my Instagram DMs are open. You're welcome to any type of question. Mainly football, but if you want life advice, I don't know if I can help you. Any sport, whatever. Watch a little PGA Tour golf. Just ask me whatever. But yeah, obviously football is the cash cow around these parts. Wanted to start with the Cowboys and Urban Meyer, which it kind of feels like the Cowboys are going to swing for Urban Meyer or Lincoln Riley. Now, from what Urban had told Colin Cowherd when he sat down, yeah, I'm sure you've heard of Colin Cowherd, a lot of you listen to this on the feed, what he told Colin on his couch slash chair is that if they call, you listen. And it was kind of, that was like a month ago. And the murmurs and the chatter haven't really gone away. So if he's really just being honest, and you listen, I never really take him at face value. If Jerry Jones were to offer Urban Meyer the job, he would accept it. I do think they would have to do some work to get Lincoln Riley, but crazier things have happened. But I'm just focused on Urban Meyer on this one. And I relate back last time Jerry Jones hired a big-time college coach in Jimmy Johnson, and it was a raging success. I do think there are a lot more differences, though, than similarities. One main difference with Jimmy Johnson is he had just been coaching. Like, he had been at Okie State, won. Went to Miami, won even bigger. He didn't have these mental breakdowns, the physical ailments. He just didn't have that following him around. He just coached, and he won. I say this all the time about Bill Walsh. Like, to me, there's no comparison to Bill Walsh and Bill Belichick. Bill Walsh, again, he got his shot when he was much older in life. I think he was 60 when he first got hired by the Niners in 1979, but he made it, I think, 8 years. Or maybe it was 9 years. And he mentally tapped out. He couldn't take it anymore. Where Urban Meyer now has kind of had a tap out of two jobs. Like, Belichick and Saban, like, the difference of Bill Walsh and Belichick and Saban and Meyer is those guys are kind of unfazed by stress. Not that it doesn't impact their life, but they just keep on chugging. They just keep on cranking it out. So while Urban Meyer has had some high-pressure jobs in Florida and clearly at Ohio State, it wore him down. He couldn't last that long. Now, you could argue he just takes the Cowboy job. It's a 3 or 4 year window anyway. Just take a couple swings for the fences, ready-made team, try to get Jerry a Super Bowl. Okay, I get it. But you are taking a huge risk if you're Jerry, if you hire Urban Meyer. And don't get me wrong. I think he's got some fraudulent characteristics, but I will never dispute his coaching ability. It is top-notch. And I believe this with anything. High-level guys figure stuff out. And it's not like Urban Meyer is going from a different industry. Coaching football's the same in high school or the pros. Just some players get paid. Well, in college, let's not act like some of Urban's players weren't getting paid. But obviously a lot more money. And they make literally more money than you. But if you can coach, I think if you took the best high school coach, he would eventually figure it out in the pros. Just like if you took Bill Belichick and you took him to a high school, he would figure it out. Good coaches in any sport can coach anywhere. Now, you have to adapt, and it takes some time. there would clearly be a learning curve for a guy that's never coached in the pros. But Urban is such an elite coach, he would figure it out at a much more rapid rate, I believe, than just solid coaches. Like Belichick, the Saban, those guys figure it out. They would figure it out. Now, here's the other kicker. When I Googled Jimmy Johnson's staff, I remember watching it as a kid. I was a big Niner fan, and the Cowboys used to kick their ass for like 91, or I guess it was 92, 93. The 49ers finally got over the hill in 94, but they took a sign of Dion to do it. And I was like, I think Jimmy Johnson had a pretty good staff. Like, Jimmy Johnson was clearly an elite coach. He was a defensive guy too, but he was really kind of more of a motivator, kind of like Urban. His offensive coordinator, the side of the ball that was not his side, was Norv Turner, who Troy Aikman still credits today of being the best offensive mind he was ever around. And obviously Norv went around, not a good head coach, but a well-established, elite offensive mind for a long period of time. And Dave Wannstedt, who then went on to be a head coach, multiple NFL teams, and at Pitt, was his defensive coordinator. And he had Butch Davis on the coaching staff as well. My question with Urban Meyer is, his guys that like were part of his operation all those years at Florida, like Dan Mullen is now the head coach at Florida. Charlie Strong, who was defensive coordinator, is now, I don't even know where Charlie is, coaching USF. And think about some of the guys that he had. Okay, his like right-hand man at Ohio State, who had some NFL experience, Ryan Day with Chip Kelly in Philly and San Francisco. Well, he's now the head coach at Ohio State. So my biggest question about Urban Meyer, who would be his assistant coaches? Who would be his, definitely his defensive coordinator? And who would be his offensive coordinator? Those are pretty big question marks. Because when he's had a lot of success, Ryan Day, Urban Meyer, Tom Herman, another guy, head coach. Like all these guys became head coaches. So I actually think a bigger issue, like the stress, maybe it would get to Urban after a couple years. But Jerry just worried about these next couple years. He's kind of living in the present. He's not thinking like, you know, I want to build something long and sustainable. Jerry doesn't care. Jerry's old. He's trying to win a championship in 20 or 21. I actually think if the Browns, who probably desperately want to hire him as well, are thinking the same thing. They're trying to win and win now. Now, I thought Ron Rivera, I watched his press conference today. And God, he's got some shit to him. He's got a little swag. He's a badass. When he gets in front of a microphone, you go, you know, and I often say this, like, how do you know what a head coach is? Someone actually DM'd me that. Like, can you define what you look for in a head coach? I just think you kind of know it when you're around it. When I got a GA job at Fresno State, when Pat Hill would walk into a room, you felt it. When Andy Reid walked into a room, you felt it. I've met Ron Rivera one time. When he passed me by in that hallway at the Combine, I was just like, whoa, and we ended up talking. But he's got a presence to him. When he was in front of the microphone, he had a presence. And he said that Dan Snyder might have been the smartest thing Dan Snyder's ever said since making all his money pre-Redskins, was that in his studies over the last month, not like this is breaking news, all the top organizations are coach-driven organizations right now. The Patriots, Seattle, Kansas City. Doesn't mean they don't have a strong GM, but the coach was hired first. San Francisco. So, if you're going to hire Urban Meyer, and Jerry, I think, would empower the guy, but my number one question is who are going to be his assistants? Because they say, like, in football, you are only as strong as the staff and the people around you. You need good players. Luckily, if you take the Cowboys job, they got a lot of good players. Who's going to coach them? Because as we saw with the Dallas Cowboys, they had bad coaching, and they didn't make the playoffs. Where if you look at the other team in the division, the Philadelphia Eagles, they had their players started getting hurt left and right. They had a bunch of issues. Doug Peterson, Super Bowl winning coach, figured it out, won the division in the playoffs for the third straight year. Jason Garrett wasn't good enough. Now, would Urban Meyer have some struggles? Like, in college, here's the other X factor if you take the Cowboys job if you're Urban Meyer. When Urban talked at Florida or Ohio State, he was the boss. He was more powerful than the athletic director. He was more powerful than the school president. The number one guy, a player at one of those universities when he was the head coach, would be nervous about them getting that individual getting mad at them would be Urban Meyer. Where with the Cowboys, like if you're Zeke, do you fear Urban quite as much? You're like, I answer to Jerry. And that's a whole bigger issue problem with the Cowboys. Can Jerry empower his head coach and go, you know what? Because if I'm Urban Meyer, I would say, listen, Jerry, you're one of the greatest American businessmen in the history of this great land. But if I'm going to be your head coach, and let's just assume I want to be your head coach, you got to stop talking. Can you just let me be the voice of the organization? Look at the Patriots, the standard in professional sports for the last 20 years. They have one guy that talks. One guy that talks. You don't hear Robert Kraft talk that much. Even before the Orchids of Asia. He just kind of lays low. Now you see him on game days in the suite with his kid, but he's not out front. Jeffrey Lurie, I worked for the Eagles. Don't ever hear him talk. Steve Briscotti with, I think I said that name right, with the Ravens. When's he ever talk? Jerry, we get it. You got a big ego. We all know how good you are at making money. You're as good as any. But just let Urban be the voice of the organization. If he would do that, then I think it could probably be successful. If he were to hire good assistants, which I'm not really sure who those guys would be. Though Urban, because he's had been at programs with so many NFL guys, is going to have really good relationships with a lot of GMs, with a lot of personnel people, and a lot of assistant coaches because they've been through his programs, or former head coaches that are now maybe unemployed. Like, would Urban Meyer hire Jay Gruden and another, you know, defensive type coach like that to be his coach? Pat Shurmur? I don't know. But he's going to need NFL level coaches because, one, all the top college coaches that he worked for, as I said, are now not just employed, they have their head coaches. Make $2 to $5 million. They ain't leaving. Ryan Day, Dan Mullen ain't leaving. So could Urban work? Of course he can. The elites at any job figure stuff out. Would there be just gigantic challenges for Urban Meyer in, especially with the Cowboys? 100%. Okay, I was watching some bowl games. Actually, I was watching the Alabama bowl game, and the first play of the game for Alabama, the backup quarterback hit Jerry Jeudy for a touchdown. It was like a 90-yard bomb. The ball flew like 50 yards in the air. And I've had this thought forever. I don't even think it's a fact now. The draft information speaks for itself. But I tweeted this out, and a bunch of people argued with me. The SEC clearly has the best players in the country, top to bottom. It's not the argument's over. I didn't say the teams. Now, their teams are better than everyone else. Typically, you know, Alabama's won, what, 5 national championships. LSU's now in the national championship. Auburn's won a national championship. They place a team every year, and rightfully so, sometimes twice in the playoffs. But that doesn't mean Ohio State or Clemson, you know, some of, like, the elite teams can't hang. And actually, the Big Ten's had a good year. But the best players in the country play in the SEC. The argument's over. Like, the argument, like, the internet's power. The internet is only going to gain more and more power. We're never going back. Argument's over. Emails, texting, like, this is the way of the future. And it will continue to change, right? I was thinking about this one, another one. Eating healthy. When my parents, who were born in, like, the late 40s, grew up, do you know what you had for lunch? Burger and a shake. You know what we do now before lunch? We fast. And then we have like a chicken salad. It kind of sucks. Trust me, I like the burger and the shake more. But those days are over. They just are. And even the parts of the country where they still kind of exist, they'll continue to die. Again, I'm as dirty of an eater as anybody. But there's just certain arguments in life that are done. Like, the SEC has better players. That doesn't mean on a given year, Clemson can't beat them, Ohio State can't beat them. Oregon's doing a good job recruiting. Back, you know, 15 years ago, Pete Carroll had an SEC-type program. But right now, all the best players, they're playing there. And we've talked about it in recruiting. I just saw earlier today, someone, maybe it was Bruce Feldman, someone tweeted, the best player in Nevada, a 5-star guy, committed to Georgia. They're all going to Georgia, Bama, LSU, Florida. Clemson's getting a couple of them. I mean, they're getting all the best players. They've become the cool league. And Saban deserves a hat tip for it. He's created a ton of commerce for that league. He's the driving force of why that contract used to be $50 million a year, and now it's $300 million a year, starting in 2 seasons or whatever on Disney, on ABC. Because of the power of him. Now, you could say it's a bubble. Will it still be as elite when Saban leaves? I think so, just because the money that conference is willing to spend on football. And I'm going to tip my hat to the Big Ten. I wouldn't say they're on the SEC's level, but they're attempting to compete at that level financially. And you keep getting the Urban Meyers. Even everyone acts like Harbaugh's an idiot. He wins 9, 10 games every year. PJ Flex, the James Franklins, like, you're going to be right there. And they're kind of like, it's like the Civil War in football. The South and the North. And those two conferences are running circles around everybody. Luckily, Clemson has this great coach, and they're kind of an outlier. And we'll see if Oregon, like, he's recruiting on that level. Can he coach on that level? It's difficult because the schedule, we've talked about it before, play the 9 conference games. It's an uphill battle. But this, I was thinking about the Seattle-San Francisco game kind of sums it all up. The Sunday night game for the NFC West. Three of the biggest players in that game in terms of impact were rookies. And they all came from the SEC. And you go, who were they? Guys from Bama? Guys from Florida? Guys from LSU? No. They came from their worst programs. The biggest play of the game was a tackle by Dre Greenlaw, who's a fifth-round starter, comes from Arkansas. By far the worst program in that conference right now. DK Metcalf, who's made plays in that game and has made plays all season long, comes from Ole Miss, a program that fired every single coach in their staff. And Deebo Samuel, who has become a Niners' go-to receiver, comes from South Carolina, a team that did not make a bowl game this year. And then when you factor in all the talent coming every year from LSU, Bama, A&M, Georgia, I mean, it speaks for itself. So the argument about the SEC being overrated, and if I hear one more person say, well, the bottom of their conference sucks, nobody cares. We don't judge you on the bottom of the conference. It's like judging the economy on the bad companies. I judge you on Amazon, on Facebook, on Google, on Wells Fargo, Walmart. That's how you get judged. McDonald's, Nike. I don't judge you on the company that went out of business down the street from my house. Who cares? It's open commerce. The rent in that building, someone else will fill it in and try to make do. You are judged on the top. And the SEC's top for the last 10 years has been better than everyone else. Now, I think the Big Ten's coming. I was texting with my guy Jeff Schwartz, offensive lineman in the NFL, played at Oregon. Because I was hard on Mario. I missed on that one. Mario's pretty damn good. Now, do I think he's like Saban dynamic? No. But like Kirby Smart's winning big at Georgia, I think Mario could do that. You know, what Kirby's done at Georgia, Mario can do that at Oregon. One, he's recruiting on the SEC's level. And all these players are leaving California. Well, he's the only guy that's kind of recruiting toe-to-toe with the big-time California guys. Herm's attempting to do that too. But you saw, like, Wisconsin's really freaking good. They were really good. If you told me Oregon or Wisconsin had made the Final Four instead of Oklahoma, I think the game, I'll go as far as say I don't think Joe Burrow has 7 touchdowns in the first half. Does LSU beat both those two teams? Yes. Do they score 55 points in the first half? No. Those two teams are much better than Oklahoma. They play defense, really physical defense. Obviously, Oregon has an NFL quarterback. Wisconsin has an NFL running back. And I actually think Paul Chryst is a really good coach. And so if I'm going to say Paul Chryst is a really good coach, you got to give Mark credit. He beat him. Now, big reason they beat him, they cost turnovers on defense. But hey, that's the game of football. Make plays. Work hard, make plays. As my guy Charles Woodson used to say. And that was just, it got me thinking. The Pac-12 is down right now. Really down. As long as the Rose Bowl exists, the Pac-12 will exist. Because I'm starting to get nervous. Like, is the Pac-12 just going to just go away? You know, I mean, it's just terrible football right now. But luckily, Mario's playing at a high level and recruiting at a high level. Herm's coming. But man, the SEC right now is running circles around everybody. Okay, let's dive into the playoff games. Because it's wild card weekend, baby. Okay, playoff games. Here's what I'm going to do. Start on Saturday. I'm going to work my way through to Sunday afternoon. I'll spend a little more time on this than I usually would when we just had a bunch of games on Sunday. We'll start with the first game. The Bills at the Texans. Maybe I'm clearly not a doctor. I thought a torn pec meant like out for the season, meaning like a 6-month injury. But J.J. Watt is back. Also, Quan Alexander, the Niners are on a bye, same injury, he's back. I don't quite get it. Been following the sport pretty closely now for about a decade. I don't know what these guys are doing. They must have some special rehab because I always thought it was like an ACL. Like, you're just out till the next season. regardless if it's week one. But the dude's back. Now, I know it wasn't week one, but it was early in the season. So that will help. Because even though I don't think JJ looked the same this season, at the time when he got hurt, he was leading the league in pressures. And when you look at their defense, it's not great. One, just the Houston Texans team is not great. It's pretty flawed. But J.J. Watt is one of their difference makers when he's healthy, and if he's on the field, that's a big difference for them. You would say, here's what I did for all the games. I just did better coach, better quarterback, and an X factor. So the better coach in this game, I would lean Sean McDermott. If you told me I could have Sean McDermott or Bill O'Brien, I would take Sean McDermott. Obviously, Bill O'Brien has accomplished more in his career. He's been a head coach longer. He's been in the playoffs now, I think, 4 or 5 years. I'm a Bill O'Brien guy, or I guess at least was up until he had a game. When was that game? When was the game that I was crushing him for? Was it like, I don't even remember now. I can't even think straight. But it was a game against somebody, Tampa. And he didn't challenge. It's just like, I can't do Bill O'Brien. I want to like him, but I would take Sean McDermott. Now, the better quarterback in this game, huge, huge advantage for the Houston Texans. But I don't think Deshaun Watson's been playing that well. I heard Cosell talking about it just when you're just watching him on television. He's just been a little off. Now, they're not the same offense when Will Fuller is hurt. And I think I saw today he either, I don't know if he practiced, bad hamstring. Reality with speed guys with hamstrings, I don't think you can depend on him. So, to me, you got the better coach, Sean McDermott. You got the better quarterback, Bill O'Brien, so it's kind of a wash. Here are the X factor. Well, for the Houston Texans, it's DeAndre Hopkins, who's just one of the pound-for-pound best players in the league and can just take over. And for the Buffalo Bills, it's the defense. Their defense is fantastic. So you go, okay, that's kind of a wash. I want to bet on the Bills so bad, I just don't trust Josh Allen in a situation in a big game. Like, can he hit just big passes? I'm not talking about, like, hit a deep bomb in the second quarter to tie the game at 7. I'm talking about in the third and fourth quarter when it's 3rd and 8, 3rd and 11, 3rd and 6, and the guy runs an out route. Can he hit him in the hands? Or is he going to airmail him? And when they do dial up a couple deep shots, let's say it's 14-14 in the second half, and they dial up a deep shot and they got the guy, does he airmail him? Because I've seen him do that too often. If he doesn't, the Bills can win this game. Because their team is better. But their quarterback, it's hard to trust in this situation. I find it difficult to think that the Bills can overcome a bad game by Josh Allen. Now, if he doesn't turn the ball over and he is just accurate in for his level, I don't need 70%, but I just no turnovers, you'll have a chance. And it's not like the Houston Texans is some crazy home field advantage. So I'm rooting for the Bills. I want to pick the Bills. Houston's probably the safe bet, but hell, screw it. I'll take the Bills in this game. Mainly just going the X factor of their defense. And they have, you know, the corner White from LSU to go up against Hopkins. And then I'll just keep my fingers crossed Josh Allen can make some plays. It's a pretty good game. This is a pretty good Saturday afternoon opening to the NFL playoffs. I can't complain. Game 2. Tennessee at New England. Pretty clear who's got the best quarterback and coach in this game. I think the coach, it's a no-brainer, Belichick. If you just wanted to go in a vacuum of recent weeks, you go, yeah, Ryan Tannehill's playing better than Tom Brady. But under no circumstances can I say with a straight face, you'd rather have Tom Brady than Ryan Tannehill than Tom Brady in a playoff game. Even the biggest Patriot haters would agree with me there. Titans are getting 5 points on the road, which is kind of crazy. If I would have said the New England Patriots are hosting a 6 seed and they got Ryan Tannehill as a quarterback, you'd be like a 10-point favorite. That's where the X factor comes in. The elephant in the room in this game, is this the last Brady Belichick game? And it feels kind of real. Like, if they were to lose this game, is Tom going to retire? Is Tom going to go play somewhere else? What's going on? I don't necessarily know. I kind of hope Tom just leaves. I just would like to see a new quarterback. Just mix it up. Every good thing eventually comes to an end. But here's the other thing that I remember from the Titans. 3 weeks ago, when the division was still a possibility for them, they hosted the Houston Texans. And the Texans kind of took it to them. Now, the next 2 weeks, they played well. The next week, they played the New Orleans Saints. And I think Derrick Henry was out that game, and it was still really competitive. And then obviously last week they won, but the Titans were resting a lot of people. But Derrick Henry was running wild. A.J. Brown looked sweet. They're playing well. They got some. Derrick Henry should be able to run wild on these guys. And A.J. Brown's just been balling. And Mike Vrabel, John Robinson, the general manager, they're New England Patriot guys. They kind of understand what they look for in these big games. They know the way that franchise wired. I think that helps a little bit. I'm not saying putting much into that, but I'm taking the Titans. And I'm not some Patriot hater. If anything, I'm a Patriots stan. I think Belichick's the greatest coach ever. I think Brady's the greatest quarterback ever. And I think they've had one of the great 20-year runs in the history of sports. You could argue it with modern-day salary caps and the draft, and they've had the greatest 20-year run ever in sports. You could argue that when you wanted to factor in free agency. But everything eventually comes to an end. And it does feel like their mojo. How, with the wild card on the line at home, would Belichick and Brady lose to the Miami Dolphins? And they did. So, yeah, I don't think this is just some fake talking point, you know, debate show bullshit. I think the Patriots have really real issues. They've showed it to us over and over and over again. But last week at Foxborough was the craziest. And every Patriot fan would tell you, that's insane. Lose to the Dolphins at home when the number two seed on the line? Now, I'm not even that big of a believer in Tennessee. I just think they got some pretty good big impact players, and I think Tannehill's played pretty well this year. And I want to bet on underdog. I'm actually thinking about doing a little parlay with the Tennessee Titans and the Buffalo Bills. Seems a little extreme, but I actually like the Titans in this game more than I do the Bills against Houston. It's kind of crazy that the New England Patriots, there's a chance for them not to make it to the second week of the playoffs. They were 11-1 like a month ago. Think about that. Minnesota at the Saints. Coach, quarterback, Saints. X-Factor. There's only one X-Factor, and that's just the Saints are a dramatically better franchise, dramatically better operation, dramatically better franchise might be strong. The Minnesota Vikings have been solid. But since they signed Kirk Cousins, they've been off. And I would say the X-Factor for the Vikings is Cousins. He's 0-9 in the primetime games. Nobody, and I repeat, nobody beside his family trusts him in a big spot. How in a million years do I expect him to go into the dome, arguably the hardest place to play in the NFL, definitely in the NFC, beside like Seattle, and win a game? When the Saints have to be one of the best number three seeds I've ever seen, because even Packer fans would tell you, like, yeah, we're good, but I don't know if we should be the number two seed. This should have been the two seed. But the way the tiebreakers worked out, they're the three seed. And now Minnesota has to pay. The only way I can see Minnesota upsetting the Saints, I look back at the box score when the Falcons beat them, and they ran for about 145 yards, and they sacked Breeze like six times. So to me, the game plan is Kirk Cousins not throwing the ball a lot. It would be like 150-plus yards just to Cook alone. Probably to run for about 200 yards. For Cousins to not turn the ball over, which would be difficult for him, and them to sack the living crap out of Breeze. That would be the blueprint. If that would be the only chance they have to win. They have no shot if it's like a Saints 49er shootout game. Cousins doesn't have that pitch in the bag. That turns into a 40-10 blowout real quick. And that's, I probably tend to see this game probably like 35-10, something like that. They're just not going to, if they can't run the ball, I don't see how Kirk Cousins throws it on these guys. I like the Saints. Line, the latest I saw, 7.5. You're probably right around that number. Hell, I might take the Saints minus 7.5. Seattle at Philly. This is a tough game. I think they're, if you go coach, you could argue it's a wash. Now, Pete Carroll's been doing it a lot longer, but Doug Peterson won the Super Bowl 2 years ago and a playoff game last year. So in the last 2 years, he has four playoff victories, one on the road against the best defense in the league, with a backup quarterback, and he won a Super Bowl. He beat Bill Belichick. The quarterback clearly is Russell Wilson, but I wrote an article today for the Athletic about the teams that the Niners might play next week. And I looked into Carson Wentz's numbers. Over the last four games, their four-game winning streak, he had seven touchdowns, no picks, and a completion percentage about 67%. And Doug Peterson told him over that stretch, it reminded him a little bit of Favre, where he just took the team and put him on his back. Now, Seattle, despite losing Chris Carson and signing Marshawn off the couch, they still got Lockett, they still got DK Metcalf, Hollister is a good player, and obviously they got Russell. Where Philly, you know, Ertz has broken ribs and potentially like a leaky spleen. Deshaun is out. Alshon, MIA for weeks. They're playing with practice squad running backs and practice squad wide receivers. And Dallas Goedert. But this, the place of the link, like that's the X factor. Home playoff games in certain markets do matter. And you could argue that Philly and that fan base, you know, for as cool as it was being the one seed 2 years ago, what really made that run special was they kind of turned into the underdog when Carson Wentz went down and Nick Foles was the quarterback. When you think of Philadelphia, what's the first thing most sports fans think of? Rocky. Vince Papale. They are the underdog. And they're literally the underdog in this game. Though, with Seattle having a million injuries too, to me it's a true coin flip game. But I think it's easy for the Eagles fans to just play the underdog role because they kind of have been over this last month. The Cowboys were supposed to win the division. The Cowboys were supposed to win the division. Injury, 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 injury. Didn't matter. Carson Wentz kind of, you know, shook the narrative that, you know, he couldn't carry the Eagles. He wasn't going to be Nick Foles. Yeah, he's not Nick Foles. He's much more talented. Now, he hadn't been playing that well, and he started playing really well this last month. Now, you could argue it was the Giants twice, the Redskins, and the Cowboys. Either way, he led them into the playoffs. If this game was in Seattle, I would like Seattle. If this game in Philly, I still tend to lean Seattle, but it's hard for me to discount the Eagles. It really is. They have the coaches been there. The quarterback has not, but he gets to kind of, you know, break through his playoff virginity at home, which helps. I mean, it really helps. That whole crowd is going to be behind him. So if Seattle cannot run the football, I like Philly. I mean, I'm going to lean Philly. I don't feel great about it. This game's really, really hard to pick. I mean, you're basically, it's like a pitching duel. It's just Russ. It'd be like Scherzer versus Strasburg. You know, it's just Russell, even though they're on the same team. Russell Wilson versus Carson Wentz. Because they got a lot of randoms around them right now. I mean, I saw Clowney didn't practice today. It's just, they got a lot of injuries. If you combine the two injuries on this team, I can't even imagine if you added up the money of the injuries that are on the sideline. But, so I'm going to go Bills, don't feel good about. Titans, my upset pick, feel good about just because I think New England's in shambles. Minnesota, no chance, like the Saints. And I'm going to lean Philly. So enjoy the playoffs. Okay, let's Middlecoff mailbag. Let's get it going. Add John Middlecoff, Instagram, slide up in those DMs. John, had a thought come to me last weekend after watching the Niners and then the Chiefs play. Travis Kelce and George Kittle are both elite talents, but they run completely different after the catch. I like this. Kittle has some Gronk to him and runs extremely violently. But with that, you have to wonder how his body will hold up. Would you rather have him run a little more like Kelce after the catch and stay healthier over the course of his career, or demoralize defenders and risk injury? That's a good question, and it's something that I've really noticed from George Kittle this season, is when he gets the football and there is a defender around him, especially someone that I would consider inferior, you know, like a smaller safety or definitely a corner, or even like a nickel linebacker, he'll lower his shoulder and try to kill the guy. And I haven't thought about it, and I praised him for that, but yeah, I would say one thing they'll probably have to work on in the offseason is just being smart about it. There's one thing, right? 4th and 5, game on the line against the Saints, breaking tackles and tossing guys. 2nd quarter against, you know, the Cincinnati Bengals, do you need to truck the safety? It's a hard balance. It really is. But if he's going to play 12 years, you're right, he's got to be smarter. He does. Where do you see sports data analysts going in professional football, and do you think it will work in the NFL? It seems like the NFL is slightly behind basketball and Major League Baseball and big data movement. I'm particularly interested in how you as a former scout feel about it when analyzing a potential prospect or trade acquisition. Is it a tool that helps or something that trumps the gut instinct of a scout? Seems like something there's tension between data analysts and scouting. This is a little overblown. Football has always used analytics. What do you think the combine is? 40-yard dash, body weight, body mass index, height, production, catches, after the catch yardage, fumbles. They've used stats forever. I think as long as you mirror those with your eyes, you won't make good decisions. To me, the biggest difference, though, and I think this goes for all sports, what separates, like, the best players in any sport, but specifically in football, and I'd even go with basketball, where toughness and physicality matter, you do have to be able to, determine who the human is. We cannot quantify everything in life. Because when you're dealing with humans, not everything is quantifiable. Like, for as great of a shooter as Steph Curry is, what makes Steph Curry truly great is he's like the greatest teammate of all time. It's like Kevin Durant wants in. Yeah, no problem. I'll pass you the ball. Like, that's how most people don't think like that. So, like, what made Tom Brady the greatest quarterback ever? Yeah, he's accurate. But it was like his innate and just incredible drive. His incredible discipline to eat like avocado ice cream. The thing that Drew Brees, that Reggie Bush tweeted out a couple weeks ago about Drew Brees, in the dome, in the practice facility, by himself, just grinding for like 3 minutes. I mean, he was in there longer than that. But it's like, you're dealing with people. Like, look at the number one data analyst in basketball, Daryl Morey. He fundamentally believes that his way is correct. Shoot threes, go to the basket. Yet every freaking time, held myself from swearing there really badly, because we know some children listen, they lose in the playoffs because they refuse to break the mold. So sometimes I say, what I never understand is I think most people are like this, most of my friends that work in the league that I would say are more scout first than number guys, they're willing to be like, yeah, I'm wrong. Why can't data, the analytical side ever admit, you know what, I was wrong? They never do that. Because in their world, this is my biggest issue with it, and I'm pro numbers. We all use freaking numbers. This notion that, like, oh, they're only going for it on fourth down now because of analytics. Every single human alive that's been watching football well before I was even born has been screaming at the coach to go for it on fourth down. It's common freaking sense. I'm so tired of that. But you're dealing with humans. And Daryl Morey's a great example of, he just refuses to go outside the analytics and he loses every fucking time. I couldn't help but cussing there because I think the Rockets are a joke. But like, Belichick used analytics. Like, you can use both. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with people. So yeah, I think you use them both. Paul D. Podesta, who's the Mets guy that works for the Browns, went on record and said that Carson Wentz wouldn't be a top 20 player. He said that with his own mouth. Those words came out of his mouth. He wouldn't be a top 20 player. They felt good about passing on him. He said that. So what, were his numbers wrong? He'd never admit it. He'd be like, the variations, the variables, blah, 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 blah. Just take the L, bro. That's my biggest issue, is like, everyone uses numbers. Now, can you use more? Sure. If the numbers make sense. But like, shooting threes in basketball is this new trend. Yeah, I got no problem shooting threes if Steph Curry and Clay are taking them. But if I want to shoot a mid-range shot with Kawhi Leonard or LeBron James, I feel good about doing it too. Like, I never understand how the analytical movement, they are so extreme and refuse to budge. They're never wrong. That's my biggest issue. They are never freaking wrong. I'll take L's all the time. I thought Mario stunk. I was wrong. I thought Baker would be good. I was wrong. I don't know what to tell you. Now, a big reason, for example, John Dorsey drafted Baker Mayfield was because he thought he had, the bravado, the Brett Favre kind of, some stuff to him. It was just the moxie. And, you can get wrong on players too. You get wrong on people too. But at the end of the day, it's the people in the business, right, that determine it all. Okay. Found via, I'm a diehard Vikings fan. If we get bounced in the first round, do you trade up and try to get a quarterback early in the first rounds? Our roster is pretty set with young, good talent all around beside O-line, and Cousins only had 1 year left on the deal. Well, here's the problem. If you guys lose, your pick's going to be what? you were 10-6, so your pick will probably be like 21 or 22. How do you trade up? Like, you're going to trade one of your second round picks to move up 10 spots to get Justin Herbert? I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, but Kirk Cousins on your team next year. So I'm a big believer in sunk costs and moving on, but it's a little more difficult when the salary cap's $200 million and you're paying the guy $27 million. So I think you just, it sucks. You either got to trade him this offseason, I don't know if he's tradable, or just roll with him one more season. But at this point in time, it kind of is what it is. Would love to hear your take on the Ross fumble incompletion during the OSU-Clemson game. I saw lots of tweets about the replay not being conclusive. Refs are not allowing play to continue close fumbles, knowing that challenges can be issued and not wanting to rule the play dead just in case. But if you're demanding conclusive, then defenses would have a huge advantage. Given this officiating philosophy, thoughts? I think it's pretty simple. You let the play go. You don't blow the whistle right away, as they do in most college and the NFL. And then you go to review. He clearly fumbled it. They screwed up the call. I mean, there's no even argument. They bungled the call. They were just wrong. Now, did that cost Ohio State the game? No. They still had chances to win. Should they? Yeah, I don't know what to say. It was a bad call. Listen to your ham pod. You and Habes opine that the Niners made the right choice taking Samuel over Metcalf. Could it be credibly argued that the Niners have potential Metcalf in Jalen Hurd? I'd enjoy hearing your thoughts, and thanks for the two thoughtful kick-ass podcasts. I always struggle with young guys that were injured their first year. I don't know anything. You know, Jalen Hurd, the kid from Tennessee, former running back, transferred to Baylor. To think that he's going to come next year and be Metcalf, in a perfect world, yeah. But this year, he didn't play all season long because he had a broken back. So I'm not trying to be a pessimist. One thing I'm trying to do in 2020 is be an optimist. But I'd have a big, fat red flag on that one. A big, fat red flag. Chiefs fan here. With Thornhill tearing his ACL yesterday, is it possible the Chiefs sign Eric Berry to a short deal for a Super Bowl run? I'd say no. That ship has sailed. But that's a sneaky big loss, man. That kid had been playing really well right next to Honey Badger. Their defense had really been playing good. I think you could argue that the Chiefs are you can't be a sleeper when you're the two seed, but they are a Super Bowl factor. And you can get them a certain betting size for about plus 450. That's pretty good value. Yo, I'm a poor college student with a love for football. I've been listening to your show for a while now. I'm a big Bears fan, and like you, I believe in Nagy's ability to coach. However, it's concerning that Club Dub was open after our win against the Vikings, second and third stringers in a disappointing 8-8 season. Do you think Nagy was right for opening Club Dub? It's hard for me to not laugh. Or that should have been used to teach mediocrity should not be celebrated. There's two school of thoughts. I would say in the 1990s, the Parcells of the world, yeah, there's no Club Dub never would have existed. In 2020, part of being somewhat of a player's coach and having fun, and I do believe in celebrating all victories in football, not like in life, you know, but in football, a victory is a big deal. You only play once a week. It's like in school, when you get an A or B on a test, like, you're allowed to be excited about it. You only take so many tests. Football, like, you don't get to celebrate practice. You don't get to celebrate film study. It's you work all week to play in the game. So it's just kind of their thing. When you say Club Dub, I just assume you mean like when he kind of like uses hands to like slam and they all go nuts. I don't think it's that big a deal. I think the biggest issue the Bears have right now is Mitch Trubisky can't be the starting quarterback next year. He can't be. I don't know how else to say it. Just heard your podcast on Cousins and how he gets paid so much and not that good. What's your feeling on Derek Carr and the future of the Raiders? Well, I think there are two scenarios for Derek. One, they try to sign Phillip Rivers or Tom Brady. And if they get one of those two guys, Derek's done. If they don't,
they might draft a guy. And if they trade up or just draft a guy at 12 or 19, let's say a Justin Herbert or Tua, I don't know if Tua's coming out, we'll find out next Monday, then Derek would just have to be a pro. Alex Smith did it, and Alex had accomplished a lot more than Derek Carr when Patrick Mahomes came in. And he acted like a pro. He indebted himself to the Chiefs. He was nice to Mahomes. Now, I don't think Derek would be mean to the guy, but it would be a little awkward. Because unlike Alex, who was kind of entrenched as a starter, and I think that year, his last year in Kansas City, had his best statistical year when he played there. And they went to the playoffs. I think that was the year they lost to actually Mariota. Think of the irony there. Mariota's now been benched in the first round when they were like the 3 versus the 6. But yeah, I would imagine Derek, unless they get a veteran, maybe I'd throw Cam Newton in there. We'll see who their head coach is and whether they keep Cam or not. But what they do, Derek will survive even if they draft a guy. That would be my take. Could the Niners secondary be their downfall in the playoffs? Whatever corner plays opposite Sherm has been punished by accurate quarterbacks down the stretch. Witherspoon has been bad stretch. Mosley makes rookie mistakes. Just a casual fan question. Yeah, I mean, I think you could argue beside, like, most teams, their secondary is going to be their downfall. Think of the NFL. Most teams don't have two good corners. Most good teams have one good corner. Hell, some teams just have one good defensive back. So the 49ers have Sherman. Quan Williams actually is a really good nickel corner. Kwaski Tartt's coming back. He's a good safety. Jimmy Ward, like, they have more than enough good DBs. If you have one quote-unquote weakness and it's one corner, you're ahead of the game, you know? I don't think, is that going to be their downfall? I think the downfall is they just get beat, you know? Every team has a weakness. The Saints are missing multiple defensive linemen for injuries. The Packers have one good wide receiver. The Ravens, do they have good enough wide receivers, you know, to win it? The Chiefs, are their linebackers good enough? The Patriots, can they score enough points? You know, the Texans, do they have anyone else besides Hopkins, Watson, and Watt? So, it's just, this isn't Madden. There's no such thing as a perfect team. It just kind of is what it is. Great content as always. My twin and I enjoy listening to the pod and following your work. Suggestion for you, ass kicker is one of your iconic phrases. Every time you say it in the podcast, it resonates. If you had to name an ass kicker of the season, who would it be? P.S. What about an ass kicker of the week segment for next year's pod? Not a terrible idea. I might have to write this down. Ass kicker of the week. If I had to do an ass kicker of the year, well, on offense, it'd be Lamar. I mean, he kicked everyone's ass. On defense, I'm trying to think of the top defensive players. TJ Watt, Minka, Honey Badger. I'm going to be biased on this one because I wasn't this big a fan. And this guy kicks serious ass all season long. So my ass kicker of the year will go to a rookie, and that would be Nick Bosa. Because, one, I didn't even want them to draft him. And two, I mean, the guy's been, he's basically the white Khalil Mack. He gets double-teamed every game, and he's just tossing dudes left and right. And I know he came right off the couch, but in that game against Seattle, he tossed a tight end and stuffed Marshawn Lynch. It's like, this guy is just incredible. He is really good. So my ass kicker of the year on offense would go to Lamar. Ass kicker of the year on D would go to Bosa. What do you think about Captain Kirk needs to do to minimally to sign another contract with the Vikes after 2020? Well, you mean 2021. I would say he would need to win a couple of playoff games. So maybe a big upset of the Saints, maybe win a second round game, maybe get him the championship game next year, maybe win a couple of playoff games. Like, he's got to win some playoff games. So you either just, he's got to win playoff games. No one cares what you do in the regular season. And let's call a spade. His regular season this year in big moments wasn't great either. So I would say right now, slim chance that he's the quarterback of the Vikings after 2021. Or I guess, yeah, starting in 2021. So next year. He'll be there one more year. The contract, you know, runs next season and that would be it. I listened to Colin's take about the decline of the Pats and how it's gradual. Do you think we are seeing the same thing with Bama, a gradual decline? With the loss of assistance and rise of another program like LSU in the SEC? I don't know. I mean, if Tua hadn't gotten hurt, they beat Auburn and they're in the playoffs. And who's to say that, you know, they would play out LSU in that game. LSU probably still beats them, but I don't know. I think Bama's still pretty good. As long as they're getting top five recruiting classes, Nick Saban's still the head coach. To me, the Patriot thing is dramatically different. Because Saban has won with, of his five national championships, I think he never had the same quarterback twice. For Belichick, there's been one constant. It's Brady. And you could say in the second iteration of the, you know, the last 7-8 years, it's been a group of guys. McCourty, Edelman, Gronk. Well, Gronk's gone. Edelman's hurt. McCourty's just getting older. Brady's 42. I would say it's different. I would not consider the two the same at all. Hi, John. Love the podcast. Jimmy G or Ryan Tannehill for Comeback Player of the Year. Greetings from Argentina. I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know if Jimmy Garoppolo can be the Comeback Player of the Year when he had like 6 career starts heading into this season. I don't think he can be the Comeback Player of the Year. He had never been a full-time starter. He started 2 games in New England, and he had started 5 to end the season in San Francisco, so that's 7, and then 3. He started 10 career games. I would give it to Ryan Tannehill. Not that, like, Jimmy Garoppolo's been better than Ryan Tannehill start to finish. I mean, he's been the full-time starting quarterback. But what Ryan Tannehill accomplished, coming off the bench, being traded, former first-round pick, battled a bunch of injuries, I think it's much more remarkable what Ryan Tannehill did. Like, most people thought Jimmy Garoppolo was going to come back and just be good. Like, we thought Jimmy was good, even though he hadn't played that much, and then he was just good. Now, he's probably been better than even some of us thought. But Ryan Tannehill, most of us thought he sucked. Like, he had some moments, then he was always hurt, then he wasn't good, then he got traded, then he was the backup, and then he came in from Mariota, a team that was not going to go to the playoffs, and led the freaking team to the playoffs. So I would go Ryan Tannehill as the Comeback Player of the Year. Mainly because I just don't think Jimmy qualifies. And I don't know if there's a description somewhere where you can read the qualifiers, but he would not get my vote. Appreciate everyone listening. 3 and Out Podcast, tell all your friends. And thanks for the Middlecoff mailbag questions. Enjoy the weekend. And enjoy some playoff football. Godspeed, and Happy New Year.